Winter Mitchell is a digital strategist, writer, and podcaster. She has spent her professional life interacting productively with various tiers of the community, working with talent and influencers. As the owner of digital consulting firm Pablo Jobs, she has contributed her journalism and social media experience to campaigns and strategies for a number of well-known brands and influencers, and hosts a new podcast she just launched called Tangent Island. Ladies, gentlemen, thems, nims, thems, I welcome Winter. I'm super excited to have this conversation. Y'all have already heard the bio. You've got the scoop. But I always like to ask people, who are you? Because you might be feeling a different vibe from the bio you've portrayed that day. You might be having a rough day. You're like, today I'm a bad bitch. I don't know. But who are you?
A survivor. I don't think, you know, I say that and as soon as it comes out, I'm like, have you survived worse than someone who maybe grew up unhoused or suffered abuse at the hands of their parents or, you know, witnessed violence? I haven't experienced that, but I think the trauma that has been, you know, central to my character, central to my personhood, requires survival tactics. So I truly do believe, as blessed as I am, and I really feel gratitude in all the ways, Jem, all the ways, I do feel like I'm a survivor, like what I've been exposed to in life. That has happened to me are also things that people shouldn't have to witness. So I'm a survivor.
Okay. I love that. Listen, I feel like most of us are surviving something always.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know nobody that's not like, I'm doing so great. Everything's perfect over here. I'm like, you're a liar. What are you doing over there? What kind of drugs are y'all doing?
And the people who say that, I'm like, really? And then they have an Oprah moment with me. I have a very Oprah energy. So then they just spill and I'm like, ooh, whoa,
you do.
I wasn't asking. I just said, how are you? Are you sure? And then you just blah, blah, blah. Just blah, blah, blah.
Okay. How did we meet? I always like to
Twitter
versions of it. The answers have been.
We met. Oh, no. We met before Twitter. We met in person because Sarissa, when Sarissa was at Meta, Sarissa's our friend, and Sarissa, love her. Sarissa introduced us at a dinner that it's interesting. I don't even think I wanted to. It's not because of any other reason other than I was probably in the middle of some trauma, but I forced myself out the house because I wanted to be around spirited, you know, professional Black folk like yourself. And I wanted to have a time, and we had a time and we met, and I was like, oh my God, I love you.
It's so fun.
And we became Twitter friends, Instagram friends, and you're just always speaking truth to power. You are honest, raw, and real, which is really the only kind of people I want around me. And I just, you know, you're an amazing follow. You were a necessary follow during the pandemic. It was always, you're a comfort, you know, you're a comfort. And I like to say that without the expectation, you know, I don't really like it when Black women are muling for people, but I think effortlessly being comforting is a gift and a skill. And that is something that you're very, very good at.
Oh, so sweet. Yeah. That's not what I thought you were going to say. So really? I will always receive a gift. No, I never know what people are going to say. Cause they'd be like, what day did you catch me? What was I doing? So this podcast is called The Trauma Within, and we today are going to have some convos that I think people are going to be really excited about and also have a lot of feelings around. Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about Black motherhood today and the trauma within that. So what does trauma mean to you?
That's a really great question. I thought about it when you first told me. You know, I feel like, I'm unpacking it a lot more as I get older because trauma is a buzzword. People throw it around a lot, especially these kids. They love, but you know, I feel like trauma is something that unseats your soul. and stays there and resonates, right? Because, you know, you don't realize until later on sometimes that something was traumatic, which is what I'm learning, you know, through my therapy work, working with my therapist, that something that I don't really acknowledge anymore, or I feel like I've unpacked and repacked and put it away, is a trauma that resonates in my responses, right? So I think trauma is, yeah, something that just unseats your soul, and you just have to reseat your soul where it disrupts that.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like a seat.
I need a comfy seat. Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Some other people need extra seats.
Extra seat.
There will also be petty moments in this.
Oh, always. So people are aware. Always. I'm here, so that's definitely for sure happening.
Put some Black ladies in a group.
True.
What was baby winter like? And when I say baby, I mean, you know, well into your 20s, because I still feel like we're babies.
Yeah.
Until we're like mid-20s.
Yeah.
Like, who were you? Like, who were you in the ways that it has shaped you to where you are now?
I was just thinking about this because I was thinking about how radical I was. I'm radical in a different way now, but back then, I think that I was bawdier. I think I was much more willing to sort of say what's on my mind and not care how it's received. I was definitely more risky. I was risque and I was risky. I literally tweeted the other day, how was I leaving my home in the middle of the night to go sleep with men in places? And when I say places, I mean, like, you know, sometimes it was indoors and sometimes it was a car and sometimes it was in the parking lot. Yep. And sometimes it was some random Yep. hotel. Like, how was I doing this when we have so much more information now about how easy it is for women to be abducted or trafficked or, you know, trigger warning, raped or sexually assaulted? I am blessed that, you know, we'll talk about it, an experience that was on its face could have more brutal mentally and more than violating physically. But yet, you know, outside of that one, you know, nuclear experience, I wasn't afraid to be sexually free. And I think that confidence, and coupled with my own personal just I can do anything in this, made me a very exceptional individual. I was very outgoing and sort of, you know, I didn't really care about looking a certain way, which I think that a lot of young women of that age are very, you know, specific about aesthetic. I'm much more specific about aesthetic now, but I was much more of a tomboy and didn't care about like being fussy and frilly, makeup occasionally, not all the time. Hair is sometimes done. A lot of, you know, back then it was scarves, now it's bonnets, but I was a scarf wearing, my hair is messed up, I don't care, going to work type of chick. My personality definitely felt like it was front and center. It was the star of the show beyond everything else. And because of my body type, I also didn't really know what I was working with. I now know because I don't have it really anymore, but you know, the full chest, full bottom, curves, like I didn't really think about it as much as men did, but you know, I just,
no, we never do.
We just never do.
We never do until we do.
Until we do. And I just,
and then we don't ever stop.
We don't ever stop. And I was working with it. I was literally like, you know, I hate to say it, but it wasn't until like J-Lo showed up and it was, and we Black women's bodies existed well before that. But then once J-Lo showed up on the scene, then it was like cool to have a big booty and to have a tiny waist and to have, you know, pert breasts and stuff like that. So then I still didn't know what I was working with, but I look back at that time and go, dang, you kind of worked it when you had to.
I love that. I often look back at who I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
And I also have like this sense of empathy.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily have sympathy. I have a lot of empathy, and I'm like,
you
were doing your best.
Right. You were doing what you had to do, right? You were doing what you had to do to survive.
Yeah, I think a lot of our 20s, especially as Black women, or just our whole lives, let's be realistic, our whole lives as Black women, there's a lot of just doing what we do to survive.
Right.
Which reminds me of like often what we are groomed to do, which is to be mothers. Mm-hmm. Today we are talking about motherhood. I like to ask my guests, like, what do you want to talk about? Because people are like, oh, girl, here's a list. And I'm like, yes. So why did you want to talk about Black motherhood today?
Because I've been on this journey probably for 5 years now. Definitely for 5 years. Maybe even longer than that. Where I've been pregnant literally 6 times. I have no babies. And it's coupled with the... It's an interesting scenario because it's coupled with the fact that I have been pregnant by the same person, my husband, and I had never been pregnant before in my life. And I am weighing the choices that sort of led me to having this, I want to say complicated. I mean, we've reached an end goal, but there is some trauma attached to the end goal. But I wanted to talk about it because I know this year is the year that I have embryos that are on ice and we're going to insert one. And I feel like in the process of getting to this point, I've reconciled some fears about it. I've reconciled some of the issues I have with myself and my independence as a Black woman who's trying to, you know, I have a successful business, but I also have a creative career that I want to really get going in a major way. And motherhood, everybody says, you can do it all. And it's like, no, you can't. No, you can't. I've done so many things in the last 6 months that if I had kids, it wouldn't have been the same type of fun, or it wouldn't have been the same type of trauma. Yeah. It's the same type of, you know, process of something that's not that great. So it's a fear, you know, there's a fear attached to it. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk that through. I felt like you were a good person to talk to about that.
I'm excited to talk about this. And before we started, I was like, ask someone that doesn't want children. Mm-hmm. I think this will be very interesting.
Yeah.
What is a mother to you? I find like people have different variations or different understandings based upon like how they were raised, mm-hmm. which can be good or bad. Mm-hmm. So that's a two-part question for me. What is a mother, or what does motherhood look like for you? And also, do you think you have been influenced by your own relationship with your mother?
Motherhood to me, I think it's interesting. I don't know how to answer that because I feel like motherhood has evolved and there has been an establishment by it throughout the ages. You know, the mother figure, since the beginning of time, there's this expectation attached to motherhood. And you know, I'm surrounded by a lot of different moms in my friend circle. And I think about one of my girlfriends she had a baby very young when we were in high school, and she didn't really snap to the mother thing until like the baby was maybe 15 months. So the baby, there was a weird relationship she had with the baby's dad and everything. And I remember us not judging her. We supported her as much as possible, but we didn't know how to raise a baby, but we definitely felt like, I don't think you're doing this right. Right. Like, you need to hold your baby. You need to take care of your baby. You can't be depressed. And then it makes the baby not to get the care it needs. And then I realized, you know, my mom, was a very active mother in the sense that as a child, she was invested in our child development. And then she hit a depressive episode that lasted several years and completely abandoned the motherhood thing. It was literally like bare minimum mothering. So, and I say this as I understand where my mother was in her life. I don't have any animosity towards my mother about this anymore, but I do understand how it has affected my sister and I. And, you know,
for sure,
my mother is an amazing woman who I'm obsessed with because she's like one of the funniest people around, one of the smartest people around. But I think, you know, she did a really amazing job up till like I was 8 or 9. And then between like 10 and 16, she just kind of checked out. And that's when I needed the mothering the most. And I'm learning that because yeah. the choices that I make as an adult still to this day are from the survival instincts I had to gain on my own and the exploration and curiosity I was embarking upon without her counsel, right? Like she just wasn't open to it and she wasn't available for it. And I think she knew how to be active in protecting us, but even then the protection was the wrong way. You know what I mean? It was anger. It was fueled with animosity versus like, I need to care and console. And now she does it, which is so funny. You know, my mom is in her early 70s. I'm in my 40s. Now she does it too much. And now we're like, okay, back up. we get it. Like, thank you. Like, it's to the point where she's like, you don't hold a knife that way or don't do. And it's like, are you kidding me right now with don't hold a knife that way? I am a grown woman.
Like, girl, you're late.
You're late. You're late. You're late.
I've been doing this.
I've been doing this successfully. It's all good. But yeah, I think, you know, motherhood is just being there. Honestly, it's just being there. And that is the truth. You have to be there. You don't, until you're not there, you got to be there.
Yeah. That's so interesting the ways that, you know, I look now as a 30-something year old whose mother was murdered when she was one. And so my mothering was from her mother. Right. So already tired Black lady who was done having kids.
Yeah.
And she got a me. And, you know, I think there's also the different generations of the way we're raised.
How old was your grandmother? A lot of
us were raised in her 40s.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Ooh, that's interesting. Okay. Keep going.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting in the sense of, you know, the ways that a lot of us are also raised by our grandparents.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I was going to get into that. Wait, I wanted to let you finish your thoughts.
Let's do it. No, let's get into the grandmas. And I was just thinking it out loud with you in this moment as it is kind of like a Black thing, which when did that happen? Like, what is that? Like in the ways that I'm not saying that all parents are not there, but there's, for many of us, there's such a strong connection to our grandparents because I don't know if the era of our parents, they weren't always present. And we was at grandma's house, Mimi, Paw, Mama, whatever you called them. This is why I was asking, like, what does motherhood look like? Because maybe you saw it in different ways.
Oh, it's...
But yes, let's talk about grandparents.
No, I'm so glad you brought that up because it's true. Like I did, I was lucky. I am lucky. My mother had her mother. She had her grandmother. She had her father. And then my father had his mother, father, and his grandmother and a stepdad. So I had a huge matriarchal, patriarchal, and I also had great uncles and great aunts around. That's so
wild. I love that.
Yeah. So I was surrounded by a lot of people that were from a different era. I was raised by golden age people before boomers, so pre-boomers, and then pre-boomers, like that's the greatest generation people. And they were my heart because they were all so different, but also Southern. So everything, you know, my husband is Southern. He's from the South. And one of the things that we connected on, you know, when we first met is that I did have an upbringing by, you know, gentle, sassy Southern people. And they were, there was a lot of growth and not a lot of expectation. They weren't really aggressive about that. They were confused by my sister and my generation, but they were willing to teach us so much that, again, the spaces where my mother could not fill, my grandparents and my great grandparents did that. So a lot of who I am today is because of them. And the reason why I'm kind of like an old lady about things, you know, I got like the party animal energy out from my mom and dad in my 20s and 30s. And then as soon as I turned 40, I was like, I'm an old lady. And they were, you know, they taught me how to cook. They taught me how to keep house. They taught me how to have some decorum and not be so, you know, nasty. But, you know, that was for the outer presentation of self. I think for the inner presentation, the inner reflection of self, they were deeply influential to me and my taste and my sensibilities, really. I'm like an old lady. I'm like the oldest 43-year-old, you know. My sensibility is so old lady. It's like everything I do in terms of my house, in terms of like the stuff I like to watch, the way I watch TV, the way I need like heat all the time.
What are you watching?
I watch a lot. I watch a lot.
Like you watching The Golden Girls with Betty now?
No. I watch.
That's fine.
What they watched in their youth, they would watch in as elderly people. So we watch, that's how I learned about like programming from, like, we would watch vaudeville and we would watch Dick Van Dyke Show and we would watch like the Nat King Cole
Hour. I watched Dick.
Okay. So then we watch all that stuff with them. So I watch a lot of stuff that I grew up on all the time. I don't like really new programming. And I even, you know, the one funny thing that I think is the funniest is that they didn't grow up with technology, right? So technology, when it came to them, was they were very, everything was specific about the purchase, about the way they took care of it. It was like an investment property, right? And so I can tell when something's about to die or something's not good quality. And that's how my grandma, like, this TV's on its way out. This stove ain't gonna work in 2 months. Like, she always knew specifically when something is about to die. So I was like, I was like my grandma like that. But no, they were very funny, interesting people, but they were, you know, they all had very different radical personalities. And, you know, my dad's parents were very conservative. My mom's parents were not. So it was just being raised by that type of dynamic. My mother grew up very poor. My father did not. So I was raised by these two different Black dynamics with two different types of expectations, which is literally how I am today, is like split down the middle, that type of energy.
Yeah. That's so, I really love that you have so many generations to like look at and like compare and grow from. And also something that I say, and maybe you can relate to this, is, you know, I call my grandmother my mom. I call my grandfather, my who just passed, my dad. And for me to look at them in this older age, now I look at them and I'm like, those are just some regular ass people that were figuring it out. Like, to now I can humanize them in the situations, but also I can like step even further and be like, damn, you were really in it. Because like you said, we have more options. We have more technology. We have whatever we have. That wasn't even an option for them to be trying to raise us. And really, let's keep it a buck. It looks, again, we can have this conversation. I don't have children, but people just, or my friends would be like, girl, I'm just making this up. I'm doing my best.
Yes, I see that all the time.
I'm having conversations.
I see it all the time. And that's what a lot of people say. And that's great, but I'm not that kind of person. I'm deeply afraid of fucking my children up. I don't think I will, but I'm also deeply afraid of being responsible if, you know, shit goes left. I watched We Need to Talk About Kevin all the time. Have you seen that movie at all? Or
no.
Okay. Well, quick. Maybe not. Yes. You've got gumption and passion and you can do it. It's about a woman. It was a book and then it became a movie. It's about a woman who is very free loving, free willing. She's a travel writer. She meets a guy. They fall in love. They have a kid. And it's basically a thesis on nature versus nurture, because the kid, it's not, I'm not like spoiling this, but if you care about these things, listeners, spoiler, he grows up to be a teen murderer. He murders everybody at school. Oh, yeah. And I know. And so it's basically, it goes back and forth between timelines. There's before it happened and after it happened. And it's in the middle, in the movie, kind of mixes the timelines. But, you know, it talks about nature versus nurture, because she is like, as soon as this baby is born. And then she kind of tries to like get into it, but he's already spoiled rotten in the other way by then. He's a lost cause, like literally from jump. And you know, I think about that all the time, because my husband and I are both head cases. So I, you know, what type, putting us together, what the hell are we going to create? I'm afraid of that.
Yes. I mean, that's, I think that's a conversation. And if you look at example, this might be rude and I hope these ain't your clients, but if you look at Love and Hip Hop, you'd be like, some of y'all should have had more conversations.
They weren't going to have any conversations. They weren't going to have any of these conversations. Those conversations were not going to be had. They weren't going to be had. Like,
sure.
No. And you know what's interesting?
They weren't, but they needed to be.
They needed to be. But the thing that's, this is going to sound so uppity black, but I was literally sitting with Alan, my husband, yesterday. We just started watching Teen Mom 2. It's just a really good few seasons.
Okay.
And it's just so good. Janelle is such a mess. The Janelle Kesha, I don't know if you remember when Janelle had tickets to Kesha, but she also had to go to jail for 45 days. So she was like, Kesha's more important than jail.
I do. I love Kesha though. So I do love Kesha, but jail, you know, we gotta weigh it out.
And I was thinking to myself, these chicks are millionaires now, and I was totally raised on like, don't be fast, don't do X, Y, and Z, stay away from these men, da da da. And I'm like, their house is like 12,000 square feet. Like, there's a different understanding and expectation of parenting these days, which in some ways probably works in our favor, but I'm just obsessive about and concerned about safety. I'm very risk averse now, because I was so risky growing up, and my husband as well. So it's like, and he had a different kind of risk, because he's a white man. So like, they're almost about to die constantly. So I'm very afraid of the moments where I'm not looking in fire, drowning, you know, if something falls on their head. Like, these are the things that I already have anxiety. So that's what I think about when I think about motherhood. Like, I have so much anxiety already. Can I handle even more anxiety when it's something out of my freaking control? I don't know. It's frightening to think about. Mm.
It scares the shit out of me. Do I think I could be a mother? Yes, I think I have that within me.
Yeah,
I think I have the protection, the nurture, the teaching. But also, do I want to do that? And then I think, no, I don't think so. Right. And I think that that's something that I have thought about over time. I also was like, by the time I'm an elder at 23, I want to be married with children. And I was like, girl, first off, shut the hell up. Yes. Ask self what?
No.
Married with children and my white picket fence.
No.
Do you think you had any pressures when you were younger to be a mother, or to even, let's even define that, to be a Black mother?
Nope. Uh-uh.
Mm, okay.
Nope. My mom and dad, first of all, I was not a marrying kind. I did not ever think I would get married. I was not expecting marriage. I wasn't one of those girls who was like, I need a ring. I'm not like that. I wasn't like that, at least. Even up into this marriage, I was not like that. My husband said, I want to marry you. And I said, well, then get a ring. I just threw that out there. And then he got one.
You're like, good luck.
Good luck. And he got it. And then I was like, oh, fuck, this is happening. I just wasn't, I didn't think that it was something that would ever happen. And it was, I was lucky that I'd never had any accidents. And I was lucky that I didn't have that strong desire. Even when I was a kid, I would like try to play with dolls and I'd be like, this is dumb. I want to play office. So I never thought about it. Honestly, I just
I'm trying to get a check
and still trying to get a check. So like, it's just not a thing for me. It wasn't, it seemed like a lot of fuss and muss. And then what happened is everybody started getting married. And then the people that said they were never having a baby started having babies. And I was like, oh, you lied. There was one friend I did not talk to for a year. And because she had a baby on me. And I was like, you lied to me. And I was so childish. I was grown when this happened too. I was like 32. So it happened. And I remember like we rekindled our relationship. And her husband at the time was like, they're not together anymore. I saw them at a really, you know, ritzy restaurant here in LA. And I ran into them and it was very emotional. And then she went to the bathroom. And he turned to me. He's an agent at a big agency, a partner, and he just ripped me a new one for abandoning her. And I started sobbing over my pasta, and I just remember being like, "I can't be like that." And that is unfortunately the kind of person I am. And unfortunately, not like that. Not like being mad because you had a baby. I'm unfortunately like I'm not going to deal with it. I'm non-confrontational because I'm so hurt. I'm going to walk away from it and let you do your thing and not interrupt or be disruptive. But you can't do that when you have a baby. You can't walk away from a baby when it pisses you off. You got to stay with the baby, no matter what.
Yeah. And you know, people do walk away, as we see all the time. And sometimes it is better for the child. Let's be honest.
Yeah. 100%.
Let's be honest.
100%. Who's that girl? The girl who killed her mom because she was being a bad mom. Gypsy Rose Lee, whatever her name is. Gypsy Rose, whatever. You know, she killed her mom.
That lady was playing with her daughter's body.
True.
Like she was going to kill her.
Yeah. Yeah. I know it was a do or die. It's a crazy thought that you give birth to someone and then it, let's get into this. You know, I had 6 abortions and they were, you know, 4 of them were necessary. 2 of them were by choice. 1 of them was just a year ago after I started working on trying to get pregnant, after I got eggs pulled out. Haven't told that story. You're getting it here first. Mm-hmm. I had an abortion last February. I was, mm-hmm. you know, my husband and I, when we first got together and we knew we were doing it and we're going to be together, I got pregnant very quickly. This man has super sperm. If you need super sperm, this man has it.
It's at the house.
It's at the house. Stop. I mean, I literally had never, I remember the one morning I woke up and we were in bed and I got out of the bed and I went to go to the restroom and I was like, And I said, oh, that's funny. I just feel dizzy. And he was like, uh-oh. And I said, oh, no, I'm sure I'm just like, I ate something funny. And he's like, I should go get you a pregnancy test. I was like, there's no way I'm pregnant. That's not possible. He went and got it, brought it back. I mean, it was possible, but I just didn't think that I have PCOS. So I just didn't think pregnancy would ever be that easy. And, I took it and then, you know, I kind of went and laid back down and then I got back up. Forgot I took it because that's how much I wasn't thinking about pregnancy and looked and I was like, what the fuck? And immediately we were excited. Then immediately I was scared. I was like, we have only been engaged for 6 weeks. We are still living in separate apartments. We are I'm not nearly where I want to be financially. You know, I can't just stop this train. So I, you know, I waffled back and forth. And then at 8 weeks, you know, right before the deadline, I terminated the pregnancy and I was bummed. He was very upset. But I don't regret it. And then, mm-hmm. you know, we tried for real. Once we got married and a couple of years had passed, we tried for real. And I got pregnant immediately and I was stoked, and it was right at the beginning of the pandemic. And I thought, this is perfect. We can't go outside anyway. I can do whatever I need to do to gestate this pregnancy and do it right. And I think, you know, I'm like 3.5 months at this point, and we go to a geriatric physician because I'm an older woman pregnant, and bomb drop. Baby doesn't look good. Doesn't look like it's healthy. We need to take a couple more tests, but it's likely you need to terminate. Then this is during a pandemic. So this is, we're talking about the typical length of things that would quickly happen in succession, were drawn out because people that were dying of this illness took precedent. So I was not even in my motherhood journey a priority. And I had to be, that took compassion, because I was like, you remember what it was like in 2020. We didn't know what the F was going on. What if any time
this was, 2 weeks went 2 years.
Yeah, it went to, yeah, exactly. Those 2 weeks went 2 years. So I'm just sitting here like, you know, sobbing and crying and depressed and scared and emotional and, you know, pregnant, and knowing pregnant and knowing that this pregnancy will not last is one of the most devastating things that I wish we could stop. It will never stop as long as we don't prioritize maternal health for women and treat women like they're just products to just mules to just be spewing, you know, babies out, and not Absolutely. Actually take into consideration like what it takes to be pregnant or getting pregnant or staying pregnant. And, you know, I had to terminate a pregnancy at 5 months, and then I got pregnant again immediately 3 months later, and I had to terminate another pregnancy at 5 months. And then I got pregnant again 3 times in 1 year, damn near almost. And the next year I got, at top of the year, I got pregnant again and had to terminate again. And that's when I was like, this is out of control. And to have doctors be like, I've never had to terminate, you know, or never had somebody lose 3 babies back to back and figure out my body and not know my body. I was like, am I supposed to be a mom? Is this what motherhood is? Is this the sacrifice, right? Like, and you see the babies. And when I looked at the babies in the sonograms, they look like me. They had my face in my profile, and they had one of them had his profile, and it was like, these are humans, you know. And so I was devastated, and each experience was different from the last in terms of that termination care. One time I had to go someplace, it was freezing and it was uncomfortable, and I was disgusted and I did not like it. One time I was treated like I was at Seattle Grey's Anatomy. It was beautiful. It was a beautiful sharing. Mm-hmm. We all cried in the room and kumbaya'd around the operating table. And then, you know, I get to this next time where I am pregnant again. So it's 5 times. I said 6 is 5. It was an accident. I wasn't expecting. And we immediately took care of it like it wasn't even a thing. We didn't think about it. There was no emotion attached to it. I found out at 3 weeks. I terminated by the 4th week. It wasn't a thing. I love that we live in a liberal state. I love as a progressive woman, I have the options. But I hate what it's done to my body. I basically have the body of a woman who's been pregnant without ever having this product. So now that I've gone through all of this, it's been this hard and I don't have a baby. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There have been times in the last few months where I'm like, then what's the point? Then what's the point here, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned a few times like the different varying degrees of like being pregnant.
Yeah.
And I don't think people really realize like there's trauma in different levels of this. Like, and like you said, in each pregnancy, it's a different experience. Mm-hmm. And you hold it differently. Can you kind of like speak to what that is for you? Because everyone's experience is so different.
I think the first time I was really excited. Not the first time, sorry, the second time. The second time I was really excited mm-hmm. because it felt intentional and planned. So I put a lot of weight into that baby. And this is morbid. If I show this. Oh, sorry, Jesus. This is his picture.
The sonogram?
The sonogram of the first one. He looks just like me. And I think that...
Did you name him?
Damien. Which is, we named him Damien because we're just like, we just felt like that felt Damien Rohrbaugh. We just felt like that was a cute name.
Sounds prestigious.
It does feel sound prestigious. And I love that name. And he loved that name. And we thought Damien was a cute name. And I was like super excited because it was a boy. And I thought, that's adorable. We're going to have a little boy. My husband already has a son who's 13 now. Mm-hmm. So it just felt like cute. Aiden gets a little brother and that's kind of adorable. And then the second one, I did not feel as connected. I felt like this is going to be a climb. Because who knows if it's going to stay. And then the third one, the same thing. Like I knew it was an easier pregnancy. The first of the three that we were trying for was really, I was sick constantly, very sick, like, you know, like green, yellow almost constantly. And by the third one, I was like, oh, you know, and the third one was, I think, the most painful because I really felt the third one. I could feel it flutter and kick. And that just felt really special and then at the end, very sad. But then the last one, I just was like, ugh, this is so annoying. And the miracle element of it, you know, people talk about the miracle of life and stuff like that. And I think it's, I do feed into that. I do buy into that because it's crazy that you make something out of love, which is why I'm struggling with the fact that I'm going to be inseminated because there's no love making attached to it. There was love in the process of us making some calls and growing some eggs and shooting some shots and stuff like that and him jizzing in a cup. But the actual making of the love to get to this baby was... You know, that it was special. I always knew immediately, this sounds so crazy. I always knew immediately I was pregnant. I'd be like, oh my God, I'm pregnant. I'm like one of those. Again, this man has super sperm.
Did he believe you?
Yeah. He would be like, oh no.
He was like, I know who I am.
He's like, I know who I am. He's like, you know, he's the saving grace and all that. You got to marry a younger man if you're going to do this because you need that young sperm. You need that young sperm.
Not the young sperm.
Young sperm.
You hear that, y'all? Get you young sperm. Don't get that elder sperm.
Don't get that elder sperm. Get you some grade A corn-fed young sperm.
Also corn-fed. Important.
Important. Important. Corn-fed. Young sperm. I mean, you know, like it just. Choo. So I felt like, and it's so funny I can talk about this now because if you listen to interviews I was giving in this process, like even 2 years ago, by now I'd be sobbing. And I just have a different, I've just been through so much. I mean, I've been through so much. I think, you know, motherhood, when you ask what motherhood is, you know, I'll talk about this. You were on my show, Tangent Island. I talk about this on my show. My husband relapsed. And that is what has delayed the insemination. And he's recovered now. Praise Jesus. All praise. But, you know, that was that delayed us quite a bit. And that also made me realize, you know, he's got to be right. And he's really got to be right. And we have to be right. So, like, once he gets right, then we have to get ourselves right. And in this case, because we're on an accelerated timeline, we have to get right together. He has to get right and I have to get right with myself and we have to get right together. So there's like a lot of building blocks because that freaking, you know, we knocked down that playhouse made of blocks and now we got to build it back up. And, you know, I would ask him like, are you ready for this? And he would say it, but I would know that he wasn't. And I knew that because my husband is, you know, from a central North Carolinian, you know, Christian waspy upbringing that abortions aren't like on the table. It's just not a thing. So it was also like spiritually damaging for him, which I'm understanding now, to terminate these pregnancies, knowing that we weren't going to be able to take care of these children. The odds were really not in our favor. 50% odds this child would die the moment it was born. 50% odds they'd have disabilities that we ourselves would not be able to care for. It would just be too much for us. So yeah, we did what we could do, knowing who we are. And spiritually, that broke him. That broke him. Three in a row broke him. And he had to recover in that moment to get right in his head, deal with his substance abuse used or an alcoholic addiction, and get right on back on his spiritual path as well. It wasn't fair. I was not going to set us up for failure by, you know, insisting on something when he's not right spiritually. I just couldn't do that to him.
There's so many levels and layers to this that, like, again, as someone that's like, I don't think that's for me, I'm like, yeah, I didn't think about that. And I hope that people are also going, oh shit, yeah. But something that is always on my mind, because this is what I just do my whole life, is like mental health. And while you're navigating your body, while you're navigating these humans you're growing and a partner, and let's forget, you still are working because baby bills are always due.
Yes.
Right? Like, you're still functioning.
Yeah.
What was your mental health like? Like, how, what was it like then? And like, where do you kind of see where it's at now? And if y'all can't see, Winter just threw the head back, honey, and we're in it.
I am stronger than I've ever been now because I've been through it. I mean, okay, you know, this man, you got to love somebody if you want to go through what this man has put me through. And luckily it's, you know, our relationship, this is for another show, but is to me, it is what God intended for me to experience, because we're in love. Now, that sounds crazy because he's put me through hell. He hasn't cheated on me. Nope. He hasn't beat me. Nope. He hasn't drained my bank account. No. The comedian John Mulaney says this, that I have someone inside of me that's trying to kill me. That's what my husband has, and what was active. This killer was active and on the loose, you know, over the course of 2022 and 2023. And so, you know, I was experiencing a level of fear at home that I could not let other people know about. There was nothing anyone else could do. There was no one that was going to stop an active addict who was in the pursuit of his addiction. So yeah, I was hyper-focused on stabilizing the household as much as possible and keeping him healthy, as healthy as you could possibly keep somebody who's an addict, and making sure he did not die. And I can tell you, holy, I saved his life literally many times in the esoteric sense, all the time, daily, but in the literal sense, my husband died on the operating table and came back to life. If I was 2 minutes later when I discovered him after he had a crazy accident at home where he fell into glass and stabbed himself with glass by the fall, if I were 2 minutes later, he would have been dead. I would have been a widow. We'd be talking about being a widow right now. So when I talk about, like, when they talk about, for better or worse, sickness and health, this motherfucker really,
they meant that.
He meant that, because that is literally what I did. Now, I keep talking about him. What about me? That this last year is when I literally said, you have a job to do to him on your own, and I can't be a part of it. So we separated for a while. And that was okay. Him going into
that sounds hard also.
Also hard, but fantastic for me because it allowed okay. me to really start being able to make a decision without being worried or concerned about his decisions affecting my decision, because I had to turn to him immediately once that decision was made. And it was more about me dealing with me and how my reaction and response to this, and dealing with my resentment and dealing with my anger and dealing with my betrayal, the betrayal, you know, I felt betrayed because when addicts lie. So if, you know, they're going
all the time,
yeah. So they're going through the process of their journey and they're lying to you. You feel like, who the fuck is this person? Who is this person? Who are you? I don't even know who I married at this point. And what kind of stabilized all that for me is that A, he did the work. He did the work. He's doing the work. He's actively in the work. And B, love. This man loves me in a way that I have never been loved. And I've been with many partners, many lovers, but I've never been loved by someone like the way this man loves me. If I couldn't trust him about the alcohol, if I couldn't trust him, which is the only thing I couldn't trust him about was the alcohol, I knew that I could trust him that he loved me. And I said, if you can take that love for me and apply some to yourself as well, and focus on getting yourself to be the person that I married, you know, then I will really believe that this love is true. And he's done it and he's doing it. And not in the way that makes just me feel good. It makes him feel good to be his healthy, sober self. So I needed to see that. And I still need to see it. You know, we're looking at like
a continued thing.
It's a continuous thing. He's in several hundred days. He's not in a year yet. So we have to see that progress going, but the work is being done. But for me, I was able to take a breath and reflect on what I've brought to the table, who I am, remind myself who I am. And I changed my mind about so many different things. I made a plan B. If this doesn't work out with him, what is my plan for me? I'm going to still have that baby. I told everybody this, all my close friends. I'm still going to have a baby. He already gave me permission. He already signed the papers. Regardless of what the fuck I do, he says, you those eggs are yours. You earn them. They're your eggs. Like your embryos. Like you,
right.
You know, like you do what you need to do, and I will respect all of it. And that's sort of like where I was. There was a plan A, you get your shit together and we're great. We have a baby in 2024. It's a little later than I would like it to be, but we'll do it. Or you don't get your shit together and I have a baby regardless. Because motherhood to me is like, I know this sounds weird, but it's like, I do want a legacy. But I also just think that where I came from ancestrally matters. And the struggle of my ancestors to get me here matters. So I kind of have like, sort of, it's like, I feel like that's how Jewish people think, which I understand, you know, that's sort of like their perception of things. But I think most people who really love their culture and value the gifts that they brought to the world want to do that for the world. So I don't take it lightly, because I don't think anything was taken lightly to get me here to this day. I have one ancestor, my great, great, great grandfather dipped from his plantation one day, was like deuces, literally self-emancipated. So, you know, I'm thinking I'd be doing him straight dirty if I didn't keep this line going, because I am so much, I kept thinking to myself, why am I like this? Why is my mom like this? And then she told me this story. And I said, this explains everything about us. We are literally like, you know what? Nah, we are badasses. We're like, nah, I don't like this. And that's how I am to this day. Nah, I'm a peace out on this. And it would just not be the right thing for me to do, is to just sort of limit my seed because I want to continue to party more without the obligation of returning home at a decent hour to relieve a nanny. So, you know, like, I think motherhood is just, there is a sacrifice to it, which I'm learning to process and be about the sacrifice.
Yeah. You mentioned like you had to kind of look at the way that you were like focused on self, like your individualism. Mm-hmm. Yes, we'll go with that. Individualism. And you said you've been learning more about that in therapy. How has that shown up for you in this process?
I think I can still be an individual regardless of whether or not I am a parent. I think that, you know, I think like my husband is learning the same thing, because he was raised in a household where once you have a child, you're a parent, right? Like you grew up in the South, and when you're in the South, you know, they definitely have a different way about sort of how they go, you know, they turn everything over to the child, right? And they just become about that. That's a lot of, you know, it's family first down there. My parents weren't like that when I was a kid. They were definitely not like, you know, we're just going to sit home all day with you and not enjoy ourselves. And that's definitely how I'm going to be. And I had a girlfriend who's a very powerful communications expert. And she turned to me one day during lunch and was like, her husband wants to have another baby. And that's fine, but we're going to need some more help. He's going to have to make some more money because I just don't want to sit with my kid all day. And on its face, that sounds wild. But then when you unpack it, she's a great mother, but she's not that kind of mother. She's hands-on as needed. She's hands-on when the moment calls. But is this like an all-day, I can't do other stuff type of deal? No, she's not about that life. And you know what? I don't disrespect that. I respect it. We work in entertainment. You know, our job calls for it.
Yeah.
And I think that in order for us to be our best selves, we have to be happy. And we have to be happy. And I think that was the one thing that my mom did not have, is she had something else to do beyond work. And I wish that she did have something that fulfilled her a little bit more, so she wouldn't have been as sad. You know, I think if she had something that was fulfilling her more than her workplace, which wasn't, you know, the workplace itself, you work in, actually, my mother is a professor. She worked in academia. Yeah. It's hard for Black women. I think if she had an experience that was less volatile, she loved teaching. She didn't like dealing with coworkers and colleagues. She would have been a much happier person in that space. And I really wish that was better for her. You know?
Yeah. So I'm going to ask the question. I know people are listening and they're like, what? So you've been through all of these things. Mm-hmm. What makes you still want to continue the process? Because, you know, I know people be looking like, that is wild. To me, I'm like, it's a goal. It seems like this is not necessarily a goal for you, but this is so important to you. Like, it's attached to you. It's a part of, like you said, your legacy and growth. But in your own words, why do you want to continue on?
I want to continue on because I want to experience childbirth. I want to have a child. I want to raise a human. I want to spend time developing them and shaping them and giving them the life that I had and more than I had. I want to make a baby with my husband. My husband is a great father. He doesn't get the opportunity to be the best dad. He's in a volatile, high conflict, co-parenting situation. And rightfully so. Again, like I said, my husband is an addict. He never, ever did anything to hurt his child, but it indirectly hurts your child when you're an addict. So he knows that. And he works on that every day. But at his core, he's a good man and a good father. And, you know, I think that our experience, you know, he was already in a marriage that was failing when his son was born. So, you know, it wasn't sort of launched from the spirit that we're trying to launch our parenting journey, which is love, just overwhelming, sickening love for one another and growing a family. So I used to think I wanted, when I first got with him, like multiple kids, but I think the new thing is like, I'd be fine with one. And I never said that before. Yeah. I used to think you need two because you have to have two because that's the way it works. And I'm like, no, I'd be good with like one solid child that gets all my attention and love and opportunity and room to grow and room to be, you know, and I that takes nothing away from my little sister. My little sister was so great. It's so great. She's gonna be like, what? It's so great. Yes, I'm coming to take you away. I think, you know, the desire is the one thing that I've learned about motherhood is what can you handle? What can you handle and what and where do you need help? You know, and as soon as I said to my mom and dad, I'm scared because X, Y, and Z, I'm scared because, you know, ABC, my mom and dad were like, we'll help you. My sister was like, I'll help you. And she's like, we'll totally help you. Like, we're happy to help. We love you. And reinforcing that family structure that I really feel grateful and a lot of gratitude for, you know, I don't have the same relationship with my husband's family. And why would I? I'm a loud Black woman that married their white son. I only saved his life, but you know, I can't have that. They're not going to give that to me. How dare you? They're not going to give, they're not peasant. They're not going to give that to me. Yeah, but like, you know, I'm ready because the thing is like everything that I think is going to be annoying about it, like, I can't go on, like we just went to Europe for 10 days. Can't do that with a baby. It's like, yes, you can. Because it's not like we went to the club every night and partied all night. But then I think about, how that little girl got missing when she lost and the nanny took over, so got trafficked or wherever. So it's like, again, like, you know, I overthink everything, but that's generally why I want to keep going. I'm a perseverer. I'm a finisher. I like to finish.
I don't think that you're also overthinking. I think that you just have more awareness.
Yeah.
Right? Like the world is moving quick. Mm-hmm. It's happening fast. It is scarier for Black women. Mm-hmm. I always say that we are the most coveted and the most hated, which is a wild sentence to have together.
Yeah.
And so we just look at things differently because we have to. Our lives. No, you're there. Yeah, you're good. Okay, let me pause.
Okay. Yeah, I can tell you that they are not being a Black woman in general is, as we know, very, very challenging for others to accept. But then being a Black woman pregnant, yeah, I got a lot. I had to fight, scream, cry, yell, slam the, I mean, these doctors piss me off so bad.
Let's talk about medical trauma for Black women. Cause this is where we are now. I feel the door has creeped open.
Yeah. Medical trauma for Black women. My experience in, we have good health insurance, like overwhelmingly good health insurance to the point where I never, like, I hate to say it like this, but it's the truth. I did not know what, I didn't know until I married my husband that you can have an 800 credit score. That's ridiculous. I'm a grown ass woman. I did not know that you could have health insurance to the point where you barely, you don't even pay for shit. So, you know, I would go to the doctor and $5 copays, 2 cent medicine, 30 cent medicine, things like that. Like I was like, I have the best goddamn health insurance and you guys are still have your foot up my ass about things that are not
really that's great.
That's like, exactly. Like that's great. It just, they don't see us as human. And I would cry and sob and scream and it would just be like deeply uncomfortable for these people to witness Black rage, to witness Black emotion. And by the way, because it was during COVID and the shutdown, my husband wasn't with me. So I didn't even get to have the person who can protect and console me with me. So by the time he'd show up to stuff, which is usually the part where they take the baby out, he hadn't been exposed to the emotional roller coaster I'd been on because he had been shielded or removed from the situation. So by the time he got there, he just got the worst part of it, which is my wife is in surgery. She's under anesthesia. Now she's coming out and I don't have a baby anymore. There was a baby in her and now there's not a baby. He would be there to, you know, when you talk to them about the process, he wasn't there. So it was just very like grotesque how they handled this stuff and the lack of sensitivity, regardless of what was going on. We look back, my dad just got COVID 2 weeks ago. My dad was like, oh, it was just annoying, but it's fine. I'm fine. My dad's 75. Like he was like, oh, it was, you know, and back then we were like, hazmat, you know, it's just like,
basically
I'm, I don't know if it was worth it or not for them. I'm not going to get into that discussion, but I know that, you know, you would think after people dying from a mystery illness that they're still unraveling, women who are trying to give birth or be pregnant would be like, or, and obviously people who have long-term illnesses like cancer, you know, dealing with that, obviously, but then women who are trying to give birth, like I wasn't a person trying to get a flu shot. I was trying to have to grow a baby, to be pregnant. And they're just not attuned to Black women on that level. There was no sensitivity in certain cases about what I was experiencing. There was no conclusive answer either. These people were not willing to do the work. I had to do all the research. I had to do Google. I had to go through forums. I spent a lot of time on Facebook forums. I spent a lot of time in, and I also realized like not a lot of Black women even get to this point to get this type of care or information because they're just not provided that they're not provided that healthcare. And I'm like, this is sick. You know, this is sick because you're trying to control our bodies, but you won't let us help you in this control. You just want to control the end of the beginning. It was really, at some points I was really disgusted with the process, to the point, Jim, like my fertility doctor's in Santa Barbara. He's not in Los Angeles. A lot of my doctors are not in Los Angeles. I will go to another county for care because I want to be cared for.
And like you said, there's so many people that don't get the option, and that forget the option, just the information, the knowledge. Like we don't have oftentimes the same conversations, right? Like let's talk. It is a privilege in many ways to not be a woman of color that is pregnant.
Yeah.
And then to be these women, I will always say Black women are the most coveted and the most hated in these spaces, but also the bodies that were studied for these cases, because we're going to keep it 100 because we read.
Yes. And by the way, the first place I went to do my IVF process, it was like a factory. It was like a McDonald's. It was like a McDonald's. You went in there. And it was cold and oppressive. The second place I went to, I thought would be better. It was in Beverly Hills. And there were so many Black women that are mules. They are having babies for other people, surrogates. And these girls are young. They are, can't, you're in Beverly Hills and you can tell when somebody doesn't have the means because they're in a, it's a different aesthetic than what Beverly Hills presents.
For sure.
So you are witnessing that to me, which is like a crazy dichotomy. And so like, I was like, what am I doing? I really just wished this could be as simple as you're pregnant. And you'll deliver on X date and just eat these things and just, you know, walk and da da da. I wanted that kind of pregnancy. And I'll be honest, a part of me knew I wasn't going to have that. And a part of me regrets not freezing my eggs sooner. But I wasn't on that train of thought. I truly thought I would just be rich auntie and never deal with that. And then I fell in love. And when you fall in love, that changes your mindset about a lot of things. So I was actively going about doing things as if I were still in this fairy tale, which is also the relationship I was in. I was in a fairy tale. We were living in a fairy tale, and then reality hit us super hard in a lot of different ways. So I definitely, you know, got a reality check. And the reality, I hate being presented with my blackness in that manner. I hate it. You know, I don't want to be the one to expect it, because then they say you got a chip on your shoulder. Da, 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 da. No, I'm aware, but I also felt like, damn, I am a pregnant woman and I am yelling in this pharmacy. I am a pregnant woman and I'm yelling in this lobby. I'm, you know, they want me to get down like that. Because they expect that, because they don't want to give me the honor of being of having some grace about what I'm going through. And what I'm going through is tragic and bullshit. I yelled at so many people. I wrote so many letters. I got so many things removed because I threatened to email like Steven Spielberg. I was like, I could get his email. And I can. And I would have. That's how desperate I was for care. That was not disrespectful. Yeah. I was going to email your board, your entire board, about this.
You know what also brings to mind? They don't know who you are. The people don't know who you are. And I say this as who you are is just like Black women in general listening to this. Mm-hmm. These people don't know who we are. They just assume you're just nothing, whatever. Like, please. These people have jobs, people have careers, like they are somebody in many ways, but it still is the idea of it doesn't matter because you are still going to be second tier. I don't care how much money you throw at us. That's not my business. I've already put you in this space, which is a historical thing that one day I hope ends. I don't foresee it yet. It's just like, I don't foresee most trauma and harm to Black and brown bodies to be ending anytime soon.
And you wonder what, like one of my embryos, I have embryos that are both genders, and the first one I want to inseminate is female. And I said, why do I want to do this to her? Why do I want to do this to her? Why? Like, why? We have a short window for innocence. My innocence exploded, you know, very early, because I was sexualized very young. I wasn't violated. But I was sexualized. I remember the first time a grown man made me feel uncomfortable. And you want to hear where it happened? You'll be like, what the F? I was 4 years old. I had this little pink bathing suit I loved to wear. So I would wear it under my jeans. I would, you know, I'm modest. I've always been modest. That's the one thing about me. You won't see me titties out. You'll see a shape skimming outfit, but you just won't see. I'm just not one of those. So I love you because you'll be like, titties out. And I'll be like, you're the best. and it's just like, I just can't do it. So, but I was wearing, like, I was 4 years old, always a dainty little girl. And I would wear like jeans and like I had an obsession with, Knight Rider. So I got myself a Michael Knight like jacket, and then I had his jeans. I was obsessed with him, obsessed with David Hasselhoff, obsessed with the car, the show, everything. And I'm older than you, so this is like 1984. So I had this bathing suit that I wore all the time. It was a Christian LaCroix, maybe, I don't know. But it was Christian Dior. It was a Christian Dior bathing suit, and it was a pair of jeans just like Michael Knight in a jacket just like his. And my mom and dad were like, we're going to LA, because I'm from San Francisco. We're going to LA. We're going to go to Universal Studios. I was like, yes, let's do this. Then they're like, they have a Michael Knight car. They have the kit is there. And I was like, yes, okay, we're going to stand in line, going to do it. Amazing. We go and get to the car. We get up. I get up next in line. And this was back in the days, y'all, like, you know, like I got on the ET ride and they picked me to be on the ET ride. And I
love that ride.
Yeah. And I was like, it was such a huge moment. Everything was like a huge moment back then. Like now it's like nothing, but then it was like a huge moment. And I get in the car and it's the way the man who was the voiceover as Kit said, oh, like that to me. That's a very pretty bathing suit you have on. And I immediately knew.
No.
Yeah.
Hate it.
And I never watched Knight Rider again after that. I mean, I watch it now as an adult because I processed it. But like, I trauma, right? Like I still think about that. And that was 40 years ago as of this year. 40 mm-hmm. years ago. And I think about mm-hmm. the first time I was sexualized as a young girl who had no understanding of sex then, who wasn't thinking about sex, who wasn't interested in sex, but I had already been programmed in my mind because my mother is mm-hmm. a rape survivor. She was raped twice as a young girl and as a preteen. A young girl, like 7, and then again at 15. So my mom had already been teaching me, like, if someone touches you here, you got to say something. Don't let anybody touch you here. What is this? What body part is this? They don't touch you there. Things like that. She might have been a little bit of heavy-handed on that, some of that shit, because it also kind of, it kind of leaked into, it shaped you.
Yeah.
But it also started like making me think I'm really curious about this stuff. You know, as I got older, I was like, well, what is this stuff that you're trying to get me to not be doing? Sex, right? Which made me very sexual. But at the time, I was not sexual. I was a little girl. And I just remember thinking, this is so gross. Why do I feel gross? Why do I feel violated? He didn't touch me. I can't see him. He can see me. I can't see him. It felt like a violation. And like that, you know, I don't even know how I got to this. Where was I going with this?
No, I think it makes sense though to me. Like months ago, cause this will come out later.
Yeah.
I released a short audio documentary around body shame mm-hmm. and body trauma called, I can't even think of the goddamn thing now. We'll come back to that. But anyway, I released this thing around body trauma and my own things. And the conversation of, we oftentimes don't notice our bodies until someone else notices it and then informs us.
Yeah.
And so for that, it's like very similar. And I think there's also the ways that you have been in the hospital and then people recognize your body in that way. And, you know, no matter where you are in entertainment, the people are always looking at your body, checking for your body. It is a lot.
It's a lot.
And so what I hear is the connections of just understanding your body and understanding what kind of got you to where you are today.
I mean, my body has changed since I've been pregnant. My breasts are basically at my knees. It is a hard pill to swallow. That is trauma for me. Every time I see my breasts, I'm like, wow, they did not look like this 5 years ago. They were not like this 2 years ago. Like, this is different. Now I'm starting to think, okay, I got to get breast. I have to hurry up and have a baby because I really want surgery so I can have the breasts I had before again. I think about, like, you know, it took me years to get over stretch marks. Years. I don't care about a stretch mark now. And then I get pregnant and I don't even have the babies. And I wasn't even that pregnant. And I have like little stretch marks on my belly. And I go, I appreciate them differently. That's a trauma, but I appreciate them. I had to process the fact that those were sacrifices for my little babies, my little angels, right? Mm-hmm. But as a little girl, as a young girl, when I was growing up, you know, I would get stretch marks. And again, this is my mother's trauma on me, mind you. So when I started getting stretch marks, my mom was angry. She was angry about my eating, even though I wasn't eating okay. that much. She was angry about the sexualization of stretch marks. Are you having stretch marks because you are having sex? I was like, these are, I wasn't. But this is just like, you know, there's all these things. Again, oh, that's what I was saying, putting this on my daughter. I want to, I think this is another, yes, why? Because I'd want my daughter to grow up in a world where she can be whoever she wants to be, whatever she wants to be, because her mom was free, fostered freedom within herself to be, to do what she wants. The part of dealing with the trauma of being exposed to my husband's addiction is when he was, when we were separated and he was away getting himself treated, I was like, I'm going to do whatever I want within the confines of my marriage. I'm not going to flirt with some dude, but I was flirty. I wasn't it with, without the intentionality of like, I'm going to hook up with them. That wasn't happening. It's very obvious. I wear my ring out every day. This ring never came off. But I was like, I want to feel alive again. But within the confines of the boundaries I've created for myself, I'm not going to play with fire, but I am going to feel like the woman that I am. I want to, you know, buy these clothes. I'm going to buy them and I'm not going to feel weird. You know, part of addiction is they get nervous and anxious and skeptical of everything. So he would be weird whenever packages kept arriving and thinking that I'm like setting up to disappear or go someplace or whatever. You know, addiction does crazy things to people. And I was like, I'm going to do whatever I want. I'm going to eat whatever I want. I'm going to go wherever I want. I'm going to take off wherever I want. My independence is important. Because I was told throughout my life, I couldn't do something. I couldn't be something. It's not going to work for you. Probably because I was a woman, definitely because I was Black, or just because of age, because I wanted shit super fast, super young. And I am working aggressively towards being the fully realized person that I want to be. And I've already achieved so much. I wasn't going to stop this process for a man, for a baby or whatever. I feel like now that my family is healing, my intimate family, my home, I have the ability to bring that to a child comfortably. Mm-hmm. And I'm comfortable with the learning experience that will create for me. Mm.
There's so much in that, but I'm gonna let the people digest that.
Yeah.
Second to last question, because I want to know, is community. Mm. Like, how important is or has community been to you, for you, during this process?
People came out of the woodworks that I never expected to hear from. Celebrities. I know that sounds silly, but it's true. But I work in entertainment, so it makes sense.
Yeah, I'm like, that's a lie.
it's like, you know, it's funny in that moment, but I've developed relationships with not only the close relationship with the people that I know intimately, because they've been supportive and protective, but other people that I never anticipated I would have a relationship with. You know, like, you have to have people in your life that are varying levels of everything. And I expect, the people that I love to be supportive. And that's not always an expectation for everyone, but I knew that. My mom and dad, always. My sister, of course. But online communities, like people online, are so invested in us having a baby and supporting me through this process, which I've appreciated a lot. I've written about it in Cosmo for UK papers. I've been on Good Morning America about it. Like, I didn't see enough Black women talking out loud about this, because, you know, there's a shame associated with it, which I, again, trauma, always working through the shame of everything.
Everything.
And I was just going through so much in my life that I was ready. I have to be an advocate for people who normally would not advocate for themselves. And I'm not saying I'm going out there, you know, doing what real advocates are doing, advocacy, which is like either raising money or being out there providing resources on the ground with people. But saying, like, as a woman over 40 in a marriage with somebody in recovery who's also trying to have a baby, who's also trying to work for themselves. Like, this is a hard dynamic, and you will survive it if you have the right people around you. And, you know, I have the right people around me. I do. And I think that every woman should have somebody that they can turn to. But more than anything, the one thing that I tell women is you need to have a medical team that you can trust, and you need to set those ground rules. I had an interview with a doctor who I could tell he was like scared. And I said, if you're afraid of this, then we can't do this. And I was clear about it up front. And he was like, I'm not afraid. I was like, you are, and we can't do this. And then I met my doctor in Santa Barbara, who was like, yeah, none of that scares me. Let's just get to it. And that's what you want. Someone who's like, go, not like go so I can take your money, go, like, let's get you this X, Y, and Z, this end result. Right. And, you know, we did this recently with my husband, and I see the difference between the way my husband is treated and the way I'm treated. And I said, and every time I go to the doctor, I say, my husband, follow up phone calls, follow up this, that, haven't heard from you. What's going on? Da, da, da. I don't get that. So I want that. I want you to be annoying with me. He gets it. And it's like, it's so normal for him. And it's not normal for me. I want to feel normal. I want to feel like I'm being cared for and protected. I want you to go against the grain. If you feel like you're not doing enough, do more. That's what I demand, and that's what I expect. And I can tell the difference between somebody who gives a shit and somebody who doesn't give a shit at all. And I'm fine telling a doctor to their face, fuck you, we're done. I don't mind having an attitude. I don't give a damn. My mom is like, she's a boomer. She's like, you can't be yelling at these people. They'll kill you on the table. Then sacrifice my black ass, because I'm not going to let you treat me like shit. You're just advocate for yourself first. And then when shit don't go the way you want it, get loud and start telling everybody about it. And that's what I did.
And I hope people take that away. Like, I hope people are reminded that they have their own autonomy. Mm-hmm. It is also, it's your body. Mm-hmm. You are allowed to say yes. You're allowed to say no. You're allowed to ask questions. You're allowed to interview them. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure someone heard you say that and said, wait, what? I could do that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And have an attitude. And I'm not saying be like loud and cussing at them at the jump, but don't you don't have to do all that with them. I never do. I'm like all those white bitches. No offense, white bitches, but I'm like them at the I'm not nice. Yeah. Why should I be nice to you? It's your job. You went into debt. You make thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know what I mean? If you looked at the bills that we racked up in the last 3 years alone, my husband and I probably had like $4 million in bills, and we have health insurance. So it's like $4,000, $14,000 in bills across 3 years. You make money off us. You eat off us. So I'm going to treat you like somebody who eats. I'm going to keep feeding you. And then you're going to be satisfied with it. And then you're going to eat some more when you've taken that in. Because you know what? That's how you live. You eat to live. So I'm giving it to you. This is your job. It's your job. If you come to me and I provide services and I don't give you the service, I expect you to come at me cross. But if I'm working my ass off and doing what I'm supposed to do and doing my damnedest and protecting you and having your back and advocating for you, you will love me for that. And that's how you should treat your medical people. Just like that. These people are getting off crazy. Venture capitalist firms are taking over healthcare, you know, companies. No, we're not doing that. I don't care who's funding y'all. Make sure I get my shit. I want my shit, and I want it top.
Hello.
Hello.
Ooh, this is so good. I'm going to be nosy because my last question is, because I'm nosy, what is the wildest thing someone has texted or DM'd you in the last 2 weeks? And wild varies. I just like to throw an intense word in for a vibe.
Hold on. I'm going to look because I want to make sure this is the what. Can you hear me? Okay. Because this is the what. This is.
Yeah, I'm in.
No, it's definitely this. So My husband doesn't have Instagram, but he got sent a meme. And the meme, he got sent a meme, and it was like a sexual position. And he was like, haven't tried this. We should, don't you think? And I was like, you're right. We should. Let's try it. Want to do it tonight? He's like, I'm up for it. Whatever you want. I got you. That's literally the back and forth. That's how we talk. That's when your husband or your partner is your best friend. It doesn't happen. You don't need a lot of like, oh yeah, baby. It's like active.
You in or no?
Yeah, you in or no? And he's like, yeah, I'm totally down. Let's do it. So
I love that.
The problem with being over 40 is now I have knee problems. So we tried it and my knee hurt, so I couldn't. So it's just missionary for a minute.
Damn it.
I know. It's just missionary until my knee gets better.
Okay. I'm gonna direct you to some support tools.
Please do.
We want you to have the sex that you want.
Exactly. Thank you.
We want you to have the sex that you want.
No, I'm having the sex that I want.
That's why I go to the gym.
Right. That's why I need to. You're exact. God damn it, Jim. You just. Yeah, you're right again. I was like, we need to go to the gym because this is ridiculous. We're not elderly, and yet I can't be on top right now, and I don't love it. So, yes, that was the wildest.
I love that exchange.
Yeah, that's
great. This has really been fun. I truly know, not believe, I truly know that people are going to listen to this and go, what the hell? I didn't know all these things about this human. And also go, oh shit, multiple times, right?
Like, I hope so.
And for me, if that's what they get out of this, then
hell yeah, we did our job. Y'all received. Thank you. And thank you for having me. Thank you. I love you. And thank you for this. This has been great. I love it. Thank you.
This is so fun. Okay. Tell the girls, the gays, the guys, theys, and nims where to find you and what you're up to. Give us your business.
You can find me at Winter, WYNTER on Instagram. I'm not giving people my Twitter anymore, but if you still linger there, it's at Winter Mitchell. If you wanna, I'm trying to build up my Instagram following again. And then I have a new show, which you are going to be a guest on as of this airing. It will probably have already aired, Tangent Island. Anywhere you listen and get your podcast, it's going to be fun. And my most favorite element of this is that it will be the first time we have the main episodes, and then we have the patron only episodes with me and my husband talking about our marriage and our relationship, which is going to be also very fun.
Y'all are nosy. You know you want to
sign up for
it. Let's be real.
We're going to let it all out.
Let's be real. Let's be real. All right, y'all. We did it.
Thank you, babe.